Tonight on the Worldview Weekend Hour, Hitler's Cross, written by Dr. Erwin Lutzer, a book I have promoted for years. It came out in 1995. Here we are, November 2019, almost 25 years later. He was seeking to warn the church about what the German Christians did and did not do when it came to the Nazi Holocaust. What does he say to the church today with the global rise of anti-Semitism? How should we respond? The Worldview Weekend Hour begins right now.
WVW-TV presents the Worldview Weekend Hour with Brandon House. Whether the topic is law, science, government, economics, history, family, social issues, education, or theology, Brennan brings the issues of today into clear focus through the lens of a biblical worldview. And now, here is your host, Brennan House.
Good evening and welcome to the broadcast. Glad you're with us. And we are honored to have with us in studio, Dr. Erwin Lutzer. Dr. Lutzer, what a privilege to have you with us. You've spoken for us many times over the years at different Worldview Weekends. And I have recommended this book of yours, Hitler's Cross. I have one of the original versions off to the side here. This is the new cover. Highly recommended. I have for years. If you want to understand what the German Christians did and did not do that we can learn from so that we, the church, might respond correctly to what's happening, this is the book. I highly recommend Hitler's Cross by Dr. Erwin Lutzer. Dr. Lutzer, for those who maybe don't remember or don't know, you are the pastor emeritus at Moody Church in Chicago, very historic church. Who was the pastor before you were there?
Warren Wiersbe, who went to home to be with the Lord recently. Mm-hmm. He was the previous pastor.
And you now also have a radio ministry that we carry at worldviewradio.com, and it's on radio stations around the world, literally. It's even in the Middle East now, right?
Well, yes, actually, we're in 17 different countries,
wow.
Brandon. And just recently, Running to Win is now available to Muslims because through Transworld Radio, we began actually just weeks ago, and so multiple millions of Muslims can listen to Running to Win.
That's
it's
excellent.
It's very gratifying for me to know that this ministry continues to expand.
Well, you wrote this book. I looked in the intro last night to see. Now, when did you write this book? Because I've had it for years. I was shocked to find out you wrote it in 1995. So here we're almost 25 years later. You were warning the church we cannot repeat the mistakes of the German Christians when it comes to what went on with Hitler and their succumbing to him and the anti-Semitism and the persecution of Christians as well. What are you seeing 25 years later that maybe you're shocked that the things you kind of talked about were coming, warned about, now they're really rising? What have you seen? What increase have you seen in that 25 years?
Well, you know, the reason I actually wrote the book is I was in a museum in Berlin. And I saw pictures of the swastika with a cross of Christ in the center. Mm. And these swastikas adorned the German churches, both Catholic and Protestant. So I said to myself, somebody has to write a book on the relationship of the church to Nazi Germany. I had several issues in mind, and absolutely, in accordance with your question, how does Hall developed even in the last 25 years? First of all, the whole issue of freedom. You know, show me your laws, it has been said, and I will show you your God. This is very, very critical for people to understand. Hitler basically was the lawgiver in Nazi Germany. When he said that the Jews were Untermensch, which is another way of saying subhuman, and that you could kill them without reprisal, he was the lawgiver. So I began to see, Brennan, how the church in Germany, its freedoms were compromised. For example, Hitler came out with what is known as the Muzzle Decree. Mm. And the Muzzle Decree said, in effect, we really have to get this for the American church. The Muzzle Decree said, in effect, that you cannot criticize the Reich in church. In fact, this is a very interesting quote that people need to ponder. Hitler told the pastors, you should stick with the pure gospel. Hitler actually didn't mind if pastors told their congregations that Jesus died for their sins, as long as they were not critical of the Reich. And that's why Niemöller went to prison. He went to prison because of the fact that he had spoken against the Reich and the intrusion of Nazism into the church. So what you see is that was an early version of hate speech, mm-hmm. and the curtailing of people's pastors' privileges and so forth. There's a story that I want to tell you that is very instructive and makes us think. Hitler said that he can break the church over his knee. He said that because the church was dependent upon the state for its salaries, he said they will cower like dogs before me. Now, very interestingly, he couldn't break the church as easily as he thought, so he decided to have a meeting with pastors. And he met with them there in Berlin, and among them was Niemöller. And Hitler railed and said, "All that I want is peace. Peace, peace. You preach the pure gospel, and I will take care of the German people, and you take care of the church." So what happened, Brannon, is Niemöller, choosing his words very carefully when he said goodbye to Hitler, said these words, "Mr. Führer, you say that we should just take care of the church and you'll take care of the German people, but we believe that we have a larger responsibility also to the German people that has been given to us by God. And you know, throughout the centuries, the church has always struggled with what is our relationship to culture? How is it that we should speak to the issues?" Now, some pastors disagree with me, but I think it's the responsibility of the pastor to speak to the controlling realities of our culture, always redemptively, always gospel-centered. But Hitler, of course, with the muzzle decree, said that you can't do that. Niemöller eventually goes to jail and then to a concentration camp. So I was interested in freedom. The other thing that interested me is what I call a cultural stream. How is it that you can take normal German boys and turn them into killers and deaden their consciences? And Hitler, of course, was a master at being able to do that. I mean, his Gestapo made sure that you committed some crime. The more crimes you committed, to deaden your conscience. And then something else that is very relevant to us today is you celebrate evil. You know, people would go to Nuremberg, and I've taken people to Nuremberg. Have you ever been to the stadium there?
No, I have not.
There?
No.
Oh, I go there every time I lead a tour to the sites of the Reformation. We go to where Hitler's rallies were held because the outline of the stadium is still there. And what you did is you celebrated Nazism. And in the very same way in our culture today, we celebrate evil. We celebrate same-sex marriage. We celebrate even abortions. You know, I've heard now of women having an abortion, and you celebrate an abortion. All of that helps to desensitize the conscience.
Absolutely.
And to help us with the leftist agenda. So
and
these
the movies,
are the kinds
of
thieves.
The movies these kids are watching today, some of them are just so graphic. Recently, this movie, the Joker movie, came out here in 2019. There were people getting up and walking out. There were people signing petitions, asking movie theaters to pull it. It was so graphic. It was so, and again, we've seen these movies that are so graphic that even the people watching them have to get up and get out of there. Isn't that all a part of this celebrating evil and desensitizing people?
Absolutely. In fact, not only desensitizing them, but here's where it becomes very personal. A school teacher in Chicago who teaches in the Chicago Public Schools said to me, "I have been told it is not enough for me to simply tolerate same-sex marriage in the schools. If I don't celebrate it, I could lose my job." So what you have in today's culture is the freedoms are being curtailed in two different ways. First of all, by laws, such as equality laws, which of course limit the freedom of religious people. But then the other thing is the shaming culture, where if you don't go along with a certain agenda, you are shamed into silence. And I would say this to the church in America today. No matter what the shame is, we have to speak the truth. Sometimes we forget that Jesus made it very clear that blessed are you when men revile you, persecute you, and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. So persecuted they the prophets that were before you. And Brannon, if you could look into my heart is to say to the church today, let us speak the truth with brokenness, humility, and love, But let's not be seduced by this idea that if we love people, we won't tell them the truth.
Well said. Let me ask you about BDS, boycott, divestment, sanction. This is a global movement to tell people not to visit Israel, pull your businesses out of Israel, don't buy from Israel, to boycott. Now, we know that the economy of Israel is very strong. There's no way they can damage the economy of Israel. We know that they, Genesis 12:3 says, I'll bless those who bless you, I'll curse those who curse you. It says that they will be a blessing to the world, and the Jews are. Their technology, thumb drives, cell phone, GPS, medical, I mean, it's amazing. Fruit and flower to the world. They're not going to damage the economy of Israel. I think what their real goal is a boycotting campaign that they're the apartheid state, they're racist, they're into a genocide, which is all a lie, but they're pushing the talking points of Hamas, a Muslim Brotherhood, CARE. They are, I believe, not interested in boycotting. I think what they're interested in is having a campaign that conditions the world to attack the Jews and to normalize the persecution of Jews, very much like what led up to, as you write about in your book, Hitler's Cross, the night of the broken glass, Kristallnacht, that occurred where they first went around marking the Jewish businesses, putting a Star of David on their window shops, but then they went in and they broke the window shops, they burned the shops, they damaged synagogues. One report says 267 synagogues destroyed. But before all that, you had to marginalize, characterize, then you terrorize, and you legalize the terrorizing. This is what I see going on today with Christians and Jews. Marginalize, as you said, shame. Marginalize, characterize, terrorize, and then you legalize. Marginalize, characterize, terrorize, legalize. How did the night of Kristallnacht compare, do you think? And many think that was the prelude to the beginning of the Holocaust. How do you think BDS compares to the boycotting then and the boycotting now? What's it preparing for?
I'd like to put your question in a different context. I believe that today the radical left, of course, they have signed up along with Islam.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because even though they have two different visions, the radical left based on humanism and their own view, Islam, of course, based on global supremacy, as all of us know, what they have found is that we are allies for now, because we are attacking America's two things that we hate very much. Number one, our Christian roots, and number two, capitalism. So what you find today is this push against Israel is a part of that. And of course, the Muslims, the Arabs especially, have always hated Israel. They want to push them into the sea. So what you have is, no matter which way it happens, you have to antagonize Israel and stand against Israel. And the way in which this is done is to talk about the rights of the Palestinians. Now, let me just say that the Palestinians have suffered a great deal. There's no question about that, because of poor leadership. But people who talk even about a two-state solution, what they're really talking about is the destruction of Israel.
Right.
Because you can't have two states together and this state has a military and all that, and they seek to destroy you. And there's no margin even between you if you go back to 1967, pre-1967 boundaries. So what we have to understand is this hatred of Israel is really even being driven by a larger agenda. And some of our politicians are openly now talking against Israel in favor of the Palestinian state, not understanding the issues that are involved. And there is always been this desire to destroy the Jews. And you know, I was reading recently in Isaiah where God says, when you march through, you know, the waters, they will not overcome you, and the fire, it will not consume you. Those are not personal promises. Plenty of Christians have died in fire and they have been drowned. In fact, recently I was to Zurich, Switzerland, because I lead tours to the sites of the Reformation there, and I took the people to the Lamotte River where Felix Manz was drowned. Those promises that God makes are for the nation Israel, that no matter how much Israel suffers, no matter how, whether it's through the Holocaust or other means, what you'll find is that Israel, I believe, deeply will always survive because God still has a future for the Jewish people. Now, I have to tell you, Brannon, that this is not widely accepted, even in evangelical circles.
It's not.
So here's what I do when I meet people who say, well, I believe that the church fulfills all of the promises to Israel.
Replacement theology.
Replacement theology. I say to them, isn't that interesting? If God is finished with the Jews, why is it that in the book of Zechariah chapter 14, Jesus comes, the Lord comes back to the Mount of Olives? What is God doing with any interest in the Mount of Olives? Why does his feet come there? I heard one professor in a quasi-Christian school say to me, oh, I think that that was fulfilled after the exile. You know, Brannon, after that I didn't say much to him, because if the Bible doesn't mean what it clearly says, we can't really have a good discussion.
That's right.
I mean, you read Zechariah chapter 14. The Lord shall descend. His feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. I know that in Acts 1 it does not say expressly that Jesus is going to return to the Mount of Olives, but it comes pretty close. Mm-hmm. This Jesus that you have seen go into heaven shall likewise appear. Well, doesn't it make sense that he appears back on the Mount of Olives?
Well, so, it says, as you saw him go, shall he return.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. And
so I would just say this, that hatred toward Israel is, of course, inspired by Satan, who's always hated Israel and seeks the destruction of Israel.
Why? Why does Satan seek the destruction of Israel?
Well, of course, Israel, because God still has a future for Israel. That's part of it. And, of course, we know that Jesus was born, you know, as a Jew. So what you find is that you have this kind of hatred that is picked up by other people. And the divestiture movement is really a part of that.
The boycott, divestment,
the
sanction,
boycott.
BDS. Yeah. So, you know, we have, I coined this term Marxianity, a mixture of Marxism with Christianity, which is liberation theology. Another term I've been using recently on a Sunday night series I'm doing on Hamas in America is Hamasianity. What I really hear are a lot of evangelical, self-professing evangelical Christians using the talking points of Hamas. Israel is apartheid state. Israel, they're involved in genocide. They're racist. Israel has no legal right to the land. Israel has no divine right. Now we have Christian ministers saying, well, they might have a legal right, but they certainly have no divine right. And then they launch into replacement theology. I'm concerned with how much evangelicalism is preaching the red-green axis of Marxism and Hamas.
Well, that's a very strong statement, Brannon. But of course, in that regard, they do intersect. Namely, that those who despise Israel, who seek its destruction. You know, I read a book years ago on how Israel, which was really, the whole world was on Israel's side in 1967. You remember when they won that war and they conquered? The whole world was in favor of that. How did that all get changed? A lot of it get changed through the media, because what happened is the media began to be so dishonest in the way in which it represented Israel. Any kind of killing that Israel did was magnified in the news. All of the crimes on the other side of the ledger were not reported. And what you have is this constant hatred for Israel pouring through the media, and so people
believe it.
Believe it and drink the Kool-Aid.
Do you know they have social media, Twitter things going around that show supposedly some girl that's been torn up by the Israeli army, the IDF, and she's beheaded and her body is mutilated, and they put it out there. Do you know that that has been proven? This has gone all over social media. This is one of many examples I could give. But do you know that that was actually just simply a Hollywood creation from a horror film, and then it got taken and the picture, the screenshot put out on Twitter, social media, say this is what the Israeli Defense Force has done? You know, the theory is, according to some reports I've read, is the first story outwins. And they push this out, and the media pushes it, and they push one story after another, and then they do, if they correct it later, small print, back page. Israel gets lied about all the time. And I keep saying to people, one of the ways we can bless the Jews, it's a blessing when someone lies about you, someone curses you, someone misrepresents you. It's a blessing when they come and say, no, that's not true. They defend you. They bless you by refuting that curse. I think what we're doing right now is fulfilling Genesis 12:3. We're blessing the Jews by refuting the lies about them. But we talk about the red-green axis, you know, pushing Marxism, pushing Islam, or the tenets or the talking points of Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, CARE. They're all the same thing. We know Muslim Brotherhood was started in 1928. Hamas started in 1987. CARE started in 1994. They're all the same thing. Even our federal government has admitted that in trials, like the Holy Land Foundation trial. So we have evangelicalism today pushing the talking points of the Marxists and the Islamists, that red-green axis, in many ways. Another way I see them doing it is through interfaith dialogue. Because I know that Syed Qutb, one of the leading scholars from Muslim Brotherhood, said that interfaith dialogue is a one-way bridge to bring the non-Muslim to our side, not the other way around. So we know Muslim Brotherhood practices interfaith dialogue. But we also know that the Marxist organization, the Gamaliel Network, that was retooled in the 1980s by a Jesuit, former Jesuit priest named Gregory Galuzzo, who Barack Obama, Chicago Mag says he threw his arm, Obama did, around Gregory Galuzzo and praised him because he helped him win the Iowa primary and then go on to become president. But Gregory Galuzzo studied Saul Alinsky, Saul the Red Alinsky, but yet he is a neo-Marxist, understood the power of interfaith dialogue, and his Gamaliel Network has all these acronyms that are Job and other biblical names, but it's social justice, neo-Marxism, posing with a Christian veneer and interfaith dialogue. They shut us down at our conferences in 4 out of 5 cities in April 2018. So here we have Hamas pushing and CARE and Muslim Brotherhood pushing interfaith dialogue, and then we have a Marxist group, the Gamaliel Network, pushing interfaith dialogue. And yet, well, then evangelicals do it. Isn't that another way we're our camp in many ways supports that red-green axis?
Let me explain what interfaith dialogue actually is.
Please.
And by the way, I've written another book, which you don't have a copy of here, in which I discuss interfaith dialogue as one of the heresies that comes into the evangelical church. I don't mind if Christians debate Islamists.
Right, exactly.
Because in a debate, you say this, I correct you, I give evidence why my view is right. I read a book, which is the basis for my discussion in my book, entitled Interfaith Dialogue, A Guide for Muslims. Mm. You can get a copy if you go online. What I discovered in this book is that these are rules written by Muslims for Muslims on how to have interfaith dialogue. What it really is, and you have to read this for yourself, is how do we sanitize Islam in such a way to make it palatable for Americans? I don't have the quotes right before me, so I'm not going to try to quote them word for word, but the whole point is simply this. In interfaith dialogue, you get to say your piece, the Christian gets to say his or her piece, and there is no correction. In other words, you're not supposed to challenge this person. He just says, this is Islam. And the Christian says, this is Christianity. And both of those views just float out there. And the problem is simply this, that Muslims, therefore, they are able to say whatever they wish. For example, one of them, in my book, I list 5 or 6 different quotes directly from the book, is that Islam has always believed in equal rights for women. How do you handle certain situations when people ask you questions? And Muhammad sought unity between the Jews and the Arabs and people of other religions. You know, anyone who knows anything about Muhammad. So on and on, what it's doing is it's saying, this is the way in which we make Islam palatable. And we must speak with care here because we recognize that these Islamists are deceived. And so we have to come to them with the gospel, but we can never, never give an open mic, so to speak, to their side of the ledger, unless you have a debate with a very competent Christian mm-hmm. who understands the issues and they debate back and forth. And yet, I hate to say this, but many people in our churches are naive. They really believe the best of everybody, and they want to so much believe that Islam is a religion of peace, that they want to discard all of the past, they mm-hmm. want to discard what the Quran says, what the Hadith says, mm-hmm. and go with a version of Islam. Most Christians, evangelical or not, have never read a single page of the Quran.
That's true.
They've never read any of the Hadith. I've read a good part of it because I've written about these things. simple fact is, therefore, they can be so gullible and they don't understand really what's going on.
Not to mention the personal stories. Sitting at this desk, we've had Usama Dakdok, who was born and raised in Egypt. Muslim Brotherhood burned his daddy's churches down all over Egypt, dragging families out in the middle of the night, Christian families, telling them to cite the Shahada and convert to Islam. And when they won't, Muslim Brotherhood, they would rape the wives and daughters in front of them, and they still wouldn't convert, and they killed them. And Usama has sat here and told these stories, born and raised in Egypt. If he were to go back to Egypt, he wouldn't make it out of the airport, he said. They would arrest him, and he would either be thrown in jail, but likely killed. We have had an Annie Cyrus sit at this desk, born and raised in Iran. Her father, a sheikh, higher than an imam. And he sold her just before she turned 14. She was sold as a child bride. She was beaten multiple times. She was thrown into Sharia jail because her hair would come out of her hijab, or she would be singing or dancing, being a teenager. Why do we not listen to the personal stories of people who have lived it in the Islamic states, and yet we want to believe what they're saying to us here? Even we know under Taqiyya, they can lie to us. And you're right, Americans, both inside of evangelicalism and outside, seem to be ignorant. And that's one reason why we produce television shows with people who lived it.
Yeah. Now, Brannon, maybe you and I disagree a little bit about this, but I believe that there are many Muslims in America that have assimilated to our culture.
Yes.
And they have imbibed
yes.
Western values.
Yes, yes.
So they're not out there trying right. to show their supremacy
right.
and impose.
We separate the Muslim from the Islamist.
Yeah. And that's why it's important for us to do that.
Yes.
Because there may be Muslims listening to
yes.
this program who say, this isn't me.
And you know what the Quran says about those that don't
yeah.
fund jihad or practice jihad. We're the infidels, and they would be called hypocrites.
Or apostates.
Yes.
You know,
what happens to them? Same thing would happen to us, right?
I want to tell you that I witness to Muslims, especially in cabs, when I take a cab in Chicago, because most of them are driven by Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
I never have an argument with them, and yet I present Jesus to them. There's a way to do that, because there's no use getting into issues of the Trinity and
right.
so forth. What you do is you show that Jesus did more miracles than Muhammad in the Quran, and they all admit that, and they all think he's a wonderful prophet. But then you point out that Jesus has this difference, that he's actually a Savior who can take away our sins. And so I use the whole analogy of someone who's an advocate for somebody else and why Jesus Christ qualifies. And then I give them a Gospel of John. Because what I want to do is to move them a little closer to the Gospel. But I remember asking one person, if you were to convert to Christianity, what should happen to you? And he went like this, I should have my head cut off. These dear people, our hearts should go out to them because they fear apostasy.
They're victims.
They are victims of, and therefore we have to deal with them with a sense of tenderness mm-hmm. and brokenness, but not by hiding the truth, but by exposing the truth and showing them that Jesus is the way. And you know, there are many that are coming to faith in Jesus
mm-hmm,
Christ
mm-hmm.
in these countries.
Yes.
And we can applaud the fact that that is happening.
Absolutely. And I think of my friend, another one from over there in the Middle East who had to escape. And he's been a guest of ours by Skype. I mean, I can't name so many of them that were Muslims and are believers in Jesus. And they're here in America, and they're the ones lifting them a shout. And they're the ones that are heartbroken that the church is compromising with them because they know firsthand what it did to them and their families and their friends and the murder. Again, we separate the Muslim from the Islamist.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Right. No.
Let's talk about the culture, where we're going. In your book, you talk about what Hitler had to do to get his SS troops to be so debased that they would be involved in mass murder. And they deliberately would get them to do horrible things so they would practice the things required to carry out the Holocaust. We know that in America, we had abortion legalized in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Then we know in the 1990s, the battle was partial birth abortion.
Yeah.
Now today, it's infanticide. So we've gone from killing the baby in the womb, we've gone to bringing a baby all the way out except for the skull, turning it around and slicing its back of its neck and pulling out its brains, as graphic as it is, partial birth abortion. And most Americans don't even know what that is. They don't even know what that involves. But we've gone from abortion, which was just going to be rare but legal, Then we've gone to partial birth abortion, where the baby's already down the birth canal. So how can this have anything to do with the life of the mother? Because the baby's already down the birth canal. Now we've gone to the next step, which is 19 states, according to numerous news reports, have legalized infanticide, the killing of baby outside the womb. What does this tell you of a death culture in America, and what is coming for Christians and Jews if this has now become the acceptable to kill innocent children? What does that say is going to be acceptable to the people who are causing the division, the people who are the racists, the biggest, the Islamophobes, the xenophobes? What does it mean for those people?
Let me approach this differently, because you mentioned the issue of abortion. In the book, I also discuss some of Hitler's views regarding propaganda. You know, Hitler said that with the right use of propaganda, you can make heaven appear like hell and hell appear like heaven. So let's relate this to abortion. When Hitler starved children, he didn't call it, "We're starving children." He called it putting them on a low-calorie diet. Mm. When he killed Jews, he called it the cleansing of the land, you see? So what you do is you say what it's not. That's propaganda. By the way, Hitler also said that hate is much better than mere dislike. And so what you try to do is you stir up hatred against the Christians and so forth and the Jews. But here's the point. When it comes to abortion, have you ever noticed this about politicians? "I believe in a woman's right to choose." Well, finish the sentence. Choose what? Whether she should make eggs or pancakes for breakfast? Of course not. They can't even finish the sentence. How does this sound? "I believe in a mother's right to kill her preborn infant." No politician has the nerve to say that. So you say she has the right to choose, or you end the product of conception. Whoever controls the language controls the debate. Mm-hmm. And that's why it is so important for us to recognize that things oftentimes in our culture, as in Hitler's, were called by another name. And that certainly is true. So you have homosexual relationships, you have same-sex marriage, which is referred to as loving. By the way, I want to speak to this issue of love for a moment, Brannon, if I may. You know, you find many millennials, especially today, saying, "Oh, we want to be loving." And so what they are doing is they're abandoning some of the hard truths of Scripture, whether or not it's the doctrine of hell or same-sex relationships, in order to be loving. When you had that famous marriage take place in Windsor Castle with Meghan and Harry, mm-hmm. the preacher there said, "Wherever there is love, there is God." Well, I want to say right here, Brannon, that that is utter nonsense. When Adam and Eve fell in the garden, they didn't stop loving. They kept on loving. But they began to love the wrong things. Mm-hmm. Lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Lovers of money. Lovers of self. So we cannot use love as it is being used today. Oftentimes in evangelical circles, we can't take the word love and make it apply to all kinds of things that justify even things that are prohibited in the Bible. Jesus said this, "This is love, that you keep my commandments." Mm. So in the Bible, love is specifically defined. It isn't just this, "Oh, they love each other so they can do A, B, C, or D."
Mm. Yeah, well said. My guest is Dr. Erwin Lutzer. He wrote this excellent book in 1995, Hitler's Cross, subtitled How the Cross Was Used to Promote the Nazi Agenda.
There's something we haven't talked about before, is nationalism. Yeah. I deal with that in the book. The fact is, I might just say it in a moment, in Germany, you have to put yourself into these shoes. Even those who died in World War I, soldiers who died in World War I were considered to be martyrs of Christ. So what you had is, whatever was good for Germany was good for the church. So you have a kind of nationalism that was it was a kind of nationalism that terribly compromised the church, because they could somehow, when I lead tours to the sites of the Reformation, Brannon, I always go to the Kaiser Wilhelm Church. Have you been there?
No, sir.
Oh my, you have to come on one of my tours. Because in the Kaiser Wilhelm Church, which is a monument today, I make the tourists look up and you see the Kaiser there, who's bringing people to Jesus. And the Germans could never quite figure out, who are we really loyal to here, the Kaiser or Jesus? And the same kind of thing can happen in America today, where we confuse Americanism with Christianity. And we can say that whatever is good for America is good for Christianity. That may be true, but not necessarily. I've been to Russia, I've been to other countries of the world where they don't have our freedoms, they don't have our constitution, and they live very differently, they live in poverty. Well, what is the true Christianity? Is true Christianity when you're in a home where at Christmas time we have so many gifts that it looks as if there was an explosion in a store? Is that Christianity or is that Americanism? Sometimes we find it hard to tell the difference.
Well, nationalism, I know, has many definitions, but the one I like to go with is the bad nationalism. The state is what is supreme. The state is of primary importance, the
yes,
state.
Right.
And yet what we see today is even within evangelicalism, many accusing Christians that maybe support some of the policies of Donald Trump, let's say. While we may not support all of his policies, we don't support everything he's ever said or done, that's for sure. But we're saying, well, we would like to see lower taxes. We'd like to see free market. We don't want to be a socialist nation. We want to see borders, national sovereignty. We want to have national security that vets people coming in here, where they're coming from. We don't want to be the policemen of the world. We don't want to fund every regime out there and drain our treasury and tax our people to give it to third world dictators. And so we want to support Israel. We applaud his moving the embassy of America to Jerusalem. So we look at all the things he's done. He's defunded UNESCO. He's done other things related to defunding parts of Planned Parenthood. So we say, well, there are things about him we like, but his America first or his nationalism has openly been stated. His nationalism is the antithesis of globalism. No borders, world court, standing world army, not the Constitution, but a global law. That is a nationalism that has been defined as the antithesis of globalism. So there is a bad nationalism where the state is of primary importance.
Not only that, but you have
But this is not what he's supporting or that we support. So, but that gets put onto us. You Christians are supporting the kind of nationalism that gave rise to Hitler. That's not true.
You know, I can speak from a different point of view because, you know, I was born and raised in Canada and I became an American citizen. I lived here, was pastor of Moody Church with permanent residency. But I became a citizen about 12 or 15 years ago. And I just want to say this, that I am a patriot in the sense that I admire the American flag. America, with all of its faults, is one of the greatest countries of the world. Canada, you know, is going downhill in many ways that are very concerning. And so what we have to do is to recognize that the left today in America wants us to despise the flag as a symbol of oppression. I know we can't get into all that in the time goes by quickly in this show, but you raised an issue that I'd like to discuss and I'd like to speak to, and that is the doctrine of the two spheres, namely the church's relationship to laws and so forth and the state, because that becomes very interesting. In Nazi Germany, the belief was that you can be a good Christian over the weekends, you can go home, you can sing songs. On Monday, you have to obey the state and you have to go out and kill Jews. Mm. And there was this sphere over here, and some say it goes back to Luther, and I've read Luther on this, and we can debate that at a certain time. But it goes back to the time when, okay, you have two spheres. You're an obedient Christian on the weekends, but you should always obey the state, my country, right or wrong.
Romans 13.
Yes. And Brandon, this is so important. In this book, thank you for advertising it, by the way.
You bet.
I talk about the confessing church. And the confessing church under Bonhoeffer and Niemöller, it went in a different direction. It was standing against Hitler. But you know when it petered out? When Hitler insisted that all the pastors swear personal allegiance to him, they finally, and I think it was in their 14th synod, they finally decided, look, based on Romans 13, we can't make a determination here. Every pastor should decide what he wants to do. And Hitler's men loved it. All that they needed to do now is to find the pastors who were willing to submit to Hitler. versus those who weren't, and they could throw them into concentration camps. If the confessing church had stood together, if they had had a declaration that says, Romans 13 is not a carte blanche that we have to obey the government no matter what, and we will not swear personal allegiance to Hitler, it wouldn't have been nearly that easy for Hitler to break the church.
Absolutely, because he got them to dissolve their denominations, unite under the Reich bishop handpicked by Adolf Hitler. And you're saying Romans 13 was the gist. But we have pastors today using Romans 13 saying that Christians shouldn't be involved in Christian activism, that no matter how vile or how evil the government is, we are to obey them. But as you said, Romans 13 is a template for what government is to do. And in fact, the case is made very well. If you don't want to fear the government, do what is righteous. But if you do what is wicked, you better fear the government, because it has the power to kill you, capital crime. So the template is showing that the purpose of government is to reward the righteous, punish the wicked, and so obey them when it is a just and orderly, God-ordained function of government. It doesn't say you must obey them at all times. The Faith Hall of Fame is filled with people who disobeyed the government.
Well, yeah, of course, you know, all the way from the midwives all the way through. But Brannon, I have a question to ask you now that I assume you don't know the answer to. Ludwig Mueller was Hitler's hand-picked man to become the Reich Bishop over all the churches in Germany. Where was he anointed to do that?
Where?
In the same church where Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses in Wittenberg, Germany. And I was just there weeks ago.
And what was the purpose of doing that?
The purpose of doing that? Well, I mean, talk about a fist in your face regarding Christianity. Here's the place. Luther's buried there. I was there just a few weeks ago because I lead tours to the sites of the Reformation, and I remind people, you are standing where Ludwig Mueller stood. And while I'm on the topic, and then I want to get to the two spheres again, because I understand some German, I stayed there about 10 years ago in that church over the lunch hour when they were having a Gottesdienst. That is a short service, okay? The man behind the pulpit read from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran, and said, in this church, we honor all three of the world's great religions, and Luther is buried right there 10 feet from the pulpit. And that's a whole separate issue as to how Europe has capitulated. But I want to get back to the two spheres. I believe this so strongly, that Christians sometimes say naive things regarding the immigration issue. Mm-hmm. They want to take the morality of the church, love everyone, take care of your neighbor, do good to the Good Samaritan, and they want to apply it to national policy. This is so wrong, because as you've already pointed out, the role of the state, the symbol of the state is the sword, Romans 13. It's the responsibility of the government to take care of their people, to protect their people. And I might say, without getting too controversial, to have some borders. It's the responsibility of the state to do that. That's the church's responsibility, is to take care of everyone that God brings to us. You know, the Good Samaritan, when he was helping the man along the way, he didn't say, now, what religion do you belong to? You know, are you here legally, illegally? So we as a church welcome everyone, and we embrace them for the sake of the gospel. But that's not the role of the state. And what we need to do is to keep the two distinct.
And yet the Germans came to believe, as you said, that their spiritual duty was to God and their political duty was to the state.
And to some extent, we believe that you should obey the state, but to the point where you can, and where you can in good conscience believe the state, but not believe the state blindly, to say, you know, my country, right or wrong, I'm going to do evil because I'm told I should. That's not the role of the Christian.
Right, absolutely. You write on page 69, 70, 91 of your book, Hitler's Cross, that Hitler was obsessed with occultism. How is the rise of the Wicca religion, the New Age movement, even radical environmentalism, pantheism, all is God, panentheism, God is in all, how is this maybe doing what was going on in Germany? Because I had sitting in the very chair you're in just a few weeks ago, Mark Musser, who wrote the excellent book, Nazi Ecology, about that thick, Nazi Ecology. And he lays out that really the Holocaust in part was also a green agenda, that it was a Babylonian occult slaughter, blood and soil, that the Jews and the Christians were the enemy because they were capitalists, many of them, some Jews were communists, I understand that, but many of them represented the Judeo-Christian ethic, the Christians and the Jews, going back to the idea of free market. They understood the process of Genesis, that man is served by nature. Nature serves man. Man doesn't serve nature. Man is above creation, and we're to be stewards. Whereas Hitler and his guys, with their New Age occultism and green energy and sustainable development policies, didn't buy that. And so the Jews, with their kosher diet and all their capitalism, they were a blight. So when you combine Nietzsche and Superman and Darwin and environmentalism and pantheism and New Age concepts and spiritual evolution combined with Darwinian evolution and societal evolution, you end up with this green agenda. It's a fascinating book by Mark Musser, very well researched. He's not the only one saying it, though. And my question is, aren't we seeing a repeat of this now with worship of nature, Mother Earth, Gaia, Earth worship, the green energy, and the war on Jews, the war on Christians, the war on capitalism, animal rights? Aren't we seeing a lot of this just repackaged?
You know, in one of our seminaries, you know that they prayed to plants. I don't know if you caught that or not, but that's how bizarre things are getting. There's so many ways that I could respond to you, but I'll just enter this discussion this way. We cannot explain what is happening in today's world and its insanity apart from demonism. When you have some of the most insane things, for example, a child in a Midwest school that I happen to know, because you can identify with whoever you want to identify. If you're a boy, you want to be a boy. If you're a girl, you want to be a boy, you can be a boy. This child said that she was a fuzzy, and by that she meant she was a cat. And if you say that you're a fuzzy, you have to respect the child who says that she's a fuzzy. Folks, for many reasons, we have lost our minds. And I think that there is a delusion that is going on in the world that is the only way to explain the stupidity that rational people are willing to accept. With regard to the occult, there is as many doors into the occult as there are interests in Americans. So you have a lot of people coming into the occult this way. They may come through some of the magical arts. They may come through the occult in various health, even ways in which much of the new kind of medicine oftentimes is based on occultic ideas and ancient ideas. You have the East and the West. But let's bring this down to the church. In my book, The Church in Babylon, I talk about five false gospels, and one of them is the intrusion of the New Age into the church. The Eastern view of reality and mysticism combined with verses of scripture. For example, let's take Richard Rohr. He wrote a book on the Trinity. It has nothing to do with the Trinity. It is New Age, totally. He says, there's no judgment in God. You are already in the flow. You don't have to have any lifestyle or any beliefs, but you're already in the flow. Earth is the fourth member of the Trinity. I have that in my book, direct quote. And you know why I included it in the book? Is because his publisher says that the largest demographic of people who are reading his book are young evangelicals. Folks, what we have to do is, we don't have to become radicals, but we do have to have a sense of discernment as to what is happening in our churches. And I just urge all of you who are listening, parents, read the textbooks that your children are reading in school. Read all of them. Find out what they are learning. Don't think you know in advance. Read what your church promotes and what your pastor is saying. And let's see if whether or not we can discern those areas which are so critical for evangelicalism and the gospel, and not allow the intrusion of foreign ideas into our worship and service.
As we get ready to conclude, let's talk about persecution. It's coming.
Yeah.
It's here in many regards. It's a soft persecution, but it's going to heat up. I'm concerned of things like universal health care, single payer. Now we're, as I wrote in one of my books in the 90s, mid-90s, about China having a Dangan open to all their citizens that follows them their whole life. Their hiring, firing, job promotions, ability to travel is all based on their Dangan. And I said, that's coming to America. That was in the mid-90s, and I got mocked for it. Now we see that people are openly talking about this coming to America and your social credit score. But then you combine universal health care, single payer, and that single payer is the government. And they can now look and say, Dr. Lutzer, we see what your worldview is. And you have something that's very treatable. Maybe it's prostate cancer and you've caught it early and you could be cured. But why would we waste our time? You're not productive human resource, your age, your worldview, and we let people begin to die. I've read in several books where Hitler's National Socialist Workers' Party and his national health care and his socialized medicine was a major regime power structure. How are people going to have freedom of speech if the government they're criticizing is the government that could save their life? They won't need rail cars. They won't need to haul you off to a rail car.
They'll just let you die young.
Speak to that.
You know, people today oftentimes back down because they are ashamed. They don't witness at work and so forth because they think that if I do, you know, my coworker is going to think that I'm this way out radical. I say to them, who cares whether or not you are thought of wrongly? Niemöller was criticized for his opposition to Hitler, and somebody said, how do you think this makes us look on earth? And he said, the question is, how do we look in heaven? And so what I'm simply saying in answer to your question actually is, if we can't take a bit of shame for the sake of the gospel, how are we going to endure when the real hard persecution comes? I don't think we're going to do very well. And part of the reason is because Americans say in their mind, they think that the freedoms that we have always been had by the church. You know, as if freedom is just something. I've given a lecture on the history of freedom in Europe, and you'd be surprised that century after century, there was no religious freedom. Under the pagans, there wasn't. Under Christendom, there wasn't. Luther was supposed to be put to death. Now, he wasn't for some interesting reasons. But the point is that we know that freedom is very fragile. And unless we have a consensus of morality and decency, as the founding fathers indicated, we cannot keep it. So the question is, how do we fortify ourselves? I tell parents, get your children to read books of great people, heroes. Read church history. And what you'll find is Christians have always been under persecution. And how did they handle it? So what we need to do is to prepare for those days. And as Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12, don't be surprised at the fiery trial which is to try you. I believe that the day may come when homeschool parents who teach their children that homosexual relationships are wrong, the kids could be taken away from them because they could be declared as unfit parents. People say, well, you know, you're a radical. I'm not a radical, but I want to just pour my heart out to you for just a moment. Francis Schaeffer reminded us that in one generation, something that is unthinkable through various things and various media things and cultural streams, it will become thinkable in the next generation. And then you have another unthinkable out there that you say, this is unthinkable. And then you wake up 10 years later and you discover it's thinkable. And on it goes. And we don't know where the bottom is. And so what we have to do is to be prepared. And always remember this. The church has been here before. It really has been. And there have been those who have been faithful and those who haven't been. And the question is, who are we going to be?
All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. If you're not being persecuted, I wonder what you're doing. Because it's easy to get persecuted today. It's soft persecution, but the hard's coming. Maybe you don't, the hard persecution is coming. And for many, it's going to be bad. Maybe you don't realize it. When you say that the unthinkable will become thinkable. In 1948, the head of UNESCO at the time declared, Mr. Huxley, that in 1948, he said, we have to begin now preparing for the acceptance of eugenics so that the unthinkable may become thinkable, 1948.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing.
Right.
Don't they?
And oftentimes we don't.
Exactly. In the remaining moments, I want to ask you about this. Why does God allow suffering and evil? Why did God allow the Holocaust?
Can I just give you the answer that I give to atheists and those who turn away from God because of evil? I took an entire course on the topic of evil in a philosophy class in college. at a university, and I discovered that there is no entirely satisfying reason. You know, you look through the Bible and you can see all these things. But this is what I say to people. Let's suppose I meet somebody who says, I'm turning away from God because if God allowed the Holocaust, I want nothing to do with him. This is my answer. Yep, you can do that. In fact, I had this discussion with a man who did some work in our apartment who told me he was an atheist. And he said, if I die and go to hell, I'll defy God for all of eternity. I said, you know, you can do that. You can try to shoot down an aircraft carrier with a rowboat if you want. But what I said to him was simply this. What you must do is to realize that God is fearful. We could talk about natural disasters. All that happens on his watch. It's terrifying to fall into his hands. A God who would allow the Holocaust, a God who will allow these terrible things happening in nature. You know, you can turn from him. But what a better decision to turn to Christ who saves us from the wrath to come. God didn't choose the attributes that he has. He is who he is, and he's going to judge the way he's going to judge. We had better present to our congregations a God who is to be feared. And therefore, we flee to the refuge that is found in Jesus Christ. That's the wise answer. To turn away from him, you're going to be a loser. But to receive Christ as Savior and as your protection from the wrath to come, then you and I become winners. It exalts Jesus. Much more could be said, but that's all for now.
My guest has been Dr. Erwin Lutzer. His book is Hitler's Cross, How the Cross Was Used to Promote the Nazi Agenda. I highly recommend it. Written in 1995, and you'll be shocked at the parallels you read today. I could interview him for hours. What other books have you written that you want them to make sure they get?
Well, I'd like you to get The Church in Babylon, Heeding a Call to be a Light in the Darkness. Deals with all kinds of issues regarding the Christian church. Social media phenomenon and all of its problems, immigration, 5 false gospels within the evangelical church, how we are to relate to this culture, the church in Babylon. Mm-hmm.
List for me real quick 7 ways the left is infiltrating the church.
Oh my, 7 ways. First of all, you rewrite history to control the future. Think about that. I can't expound on each because we don't have time, but first of all, you rewrite history. What you want to do is to destroy the monuments. What you want to do is to delegitimize our founding fathers so that you can delegitimize their documents. Secondly, is you use diversity to divide and to destroy. All this diversity training in university, the implications and the purpose is not to bring about unity and find common ground. It is to antagonize, because that's what cultural Marxism wants to do. The third is free speech for me, but not for thee. Arguments, books are being written now against free speech. Only the dominant culture should not have free speech. The only culture that should have free speech are the oppressed cultures, okay? Let me think of number 4 is the whole issue of propaganda. Say what it isn't. Did you know that San Francisco has no criminals? Did you read that? They just decided that they aren't going to use the word criminal anymore. But all this thing about controlling speech, therefore you control the debate.
Like saying out in New York, if you use the word illegal alien in a derogatory manner, they'll fine you $250,000.
It's possible. And then what you have is also the linking up with Islam, which began after 9/11, because what the left saw was an opportunity to blame America for what happened at 9/11. And therefore, despite all the flags that were flying, they were saying that the flag represented imperialism and oppression and so forth. And so there's a whole string of things there. The last one, and I may have missed one, is vilify, vilify, vilify. It goes back to Saul Alinsky.
Absolutely.
What you do is, Saul Alinsky says, you choose a target, you personalize it, and you vilify it. And so everything is hyper-vilification. Call people names, call them out, and so forth, and that's
shame
the
them.
Way. Shame them.
Because people don't stand up well to embarrassment and shame.
Right, right.
That's a psychological process.
But here I want to end, though, on an optimistic note. Jesus said, and I've been to Caesarea Philippi a couple of times, I'm sure you have also, It's right there at Mount Hermon, the Mount of Transfiguration. Caesarea Philippi, Brannan, was a hotbed of false religion. The god Pan was there and so forth. Right there, Jesus said, upon this rock, I will build my church. And the church in America is going to have to learn something, that the church ultimately isn't built on our Constitution and on our freedoms. It is built on Jesus Christ. And the time is coming when we won't be able to depend upon the media. We won't be able to depend upon politicians. We won't be able to certainly depend upon our universities. It's going to be the church and God. Hard times, but we're going to have to learn to trust God in new ways.
Herbert Marcuse said that he was going to create a coalition of victims. The poor, the immigrants, the sexual minorities, you know, homosexuals, etc., feminists, and then say, who's the one victimizing them? The Christians and the capitalist. The Christians and the capitalist. Create a coalition of victims and then blame all of their suffering and oppression on the Christians and the capitalist. Sound familiar? Well, Dr. Lutzer, I'll close with this. I don't know if it was in your book, but I read the story of Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Who said good things about the church.
He did.
And that's in my
it
book.
It is in your
yes.
book. I read it then.
Yeah.
He said that he... Do you remember the story?
I remember it well.
Tell it.
All right. Einstein said that he...
Jewish.
Jewish. He hated the church, but mm-hmm. then he began to think very positively of it. And he said this. He said, when Hitler came, I looked to the universities, those great bastions of truth. They became silent. He said, I looked to the newspapers, the media, with their flaming editorials for the need for freedom. They became silent. He said, only the church stood against Hitler's path. Now, you and I criticize the church. We say, you know, they didn't do enough and they didn't do enough. But 700 pastors and priests were thrown into concentration camps. The church did something. Einstein's point was, only the church, for all of its failings, is the only opposition that Hitler had. Everybody else went down his path.
He went so far as to say, that which I kind of disdain, I now unreservedly praise.
Yeah, the quote is in this book.
Well, another reason you should get Hitler's Cross. Again, I cannot recommend it enough. I've recommended it for years. My personal copy is off to the side. It's dog-eared. It's got Post-it notes on the side. He's seen it. I hope you'll get a copy. Dr. Erwin Lutzer also is on our radio network at worldviewradio.com, worldviewradio.com. He's one of the reformed guys I like because, as you've heard today, he understands Bible prophecy. He understands the role of Israel. He's like our friend Dr. Tommy Ice or another guy I respect, Charles Ryrie. So there are some great reform guys out there that are still keeping it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise.
You have to define reform.
You know, because that could mean you believe in infant baptism or replacement theology or who knows what, right?
Who knows what. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a loaded term.
Right.
Well, he's one of the guys we really love having a relationship with, and we appreciate his ministry. And I first heard you speak when I was 12 years old at Lake Johanna Shores Bible Conference.
Wow.
When I was 12 years old.
I don't remember seeing you.
No,
there.
I wasn't talking. That'd be rare, though, wouldn't it? I was just sitting there listening.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Lutzer.
Thank you.
Well, folks, I hope you appreciate the broadcast. Till next time, I'm Brandon House. Take care.